Good morning. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for host Charity Nebbe. It's our August edition of Wildlife Day today, and here with me is Iowa State University wildlife biologist Jim Pease, who has spent the last few months paddling Iowa's rivers, gathering biological information and data to help map the makeup of Iowa's waterways. Good morning, Jim. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. It's a beautiful day, another in a series of beautiful days out there.
And, that you've been enjoying quite a bit.
Oh, it's been fantastic. What a great summer to be out on Iowa's rivers. It's just been incredible weather. I had maybe one or two days that were, you know, in the high 80s, but gee whiz, this is Iowa.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
And also joining us to talk about this project is John Wink, the Water Trails Coordinator for the Iowa DNR. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, thanks for coming on the show today. So, you know, I'll start with having you both kind of give us a brief overview about this trip. What did you set out to find? What
Sure.
waterways were you traveling?
Well, John contacted me some time ago, last winter, I guess, we mm-hmm. began talking about this. John's the Water Trails Coordinator for DNR, and water trails are sort of a relatively new concept in Iowa. We've had lots of bike trails, of course, and rails to trails, and you know, people think about land-based trails. But Iowa is one of those states that is very, very rich in streams and rivers. And you only have to go one state to the west to realize how rich in rivers we are. If you spend some time in Nebraska or any of the Dakotas, you think, my golly, we really do have lots of rivers here in Iowa. And having grown up here, I think the best part of my education was paddling some of the rivers in southeastern Iowa as a child and a teenager. And I spent with my two brothers spent a lot of time on the rivers down there. So we really have lots and lots and lots of rivers. A gift in part from the last glaciation that came that left Iowa 10,000-12,000 years ago, and the drainage from all from that glacial mass is really the parent of the rivers that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
So John and I began talking last winter, I think it was, John.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And began talking about. These are all in various stages of proposed water trails for the state. There are some existing water trails, of course, and what they the kinds of data that they needed to really help the public. And this was really right up my alley because as a wildlife biologist, I'm a very broad, basically as a naturalist, I have a broad base of knowledge in a lot of different areas, and so plants as well as animals, kind of thing. So that really helps me. I think when I'm out on the river, I can see the big picture, not just a single species or a single group. Of just birds or just mammals or, you know, just aquatic insects. I know something about all or just a certain plant group or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be able to look at that as other paddlers would as they're going down the rivers. And so John and I talked about what their needs were, and I said, I think I can do that for you. So it's been really a real pleasure for me to be able to spend so much time this summer on and so many miles on Iowa's rivers.
And John, what needs did you have before this was underway?
Well, we've got about 1,000 miles of rivers, and we have one lake that we're actually in the process of developing what we're calling an existing conditions report. And that existing conditions reports is going to help us plan for the future on where we need to develop greater access. And more in particular, how we interpret what people, what paddlers or the local residents are seeing and what's special and unique about their particular river or lake. And we're excited really to have Jim on board because we know his caliber of wildlife biologist and we think highly of him. So we feel very fortunate to have him out there actually scouting all these rivers and logging and reporting on the type of plant species, aquatic insects, and bird species, and the types of trees that as Jim says, likes to get their feet wet or doesn't mind getting their feet wet.
That's right. Right.
And you really thought it was important that this be done using a kayak because you had a really memorable kayak experience. And Jim, I want you to jump in here as well. What is it like to take in this scenery and these views on a kayak?
Well, I grew up canoeing, but I've been in a canoe since I was probably 10 years old. And in fact, when I was a seventh grader, my older brother and I bought a used wooden canvas canoe, Old Town canoe, from the outdoor program at the U of I, and for I think we paid $80 for it, and that included two wooden paddles, you know. and I still have that canoe. I still have those paddles. And so I knew a lot about canoeing growing up, and I always said that my parents were very trusting and allowed us to. We would often go out on a Friday afternoon, and we wouldn't be back until Sunday evening. And my parents had great trust. I was able to thank both of them before they died that for both the freedom and the trust for us to do this. My wife thinks that perhaps they were just trying to get rid of us, and we kept showing up again on Sunday. but it was really, really a wonderful, wonderful way to spend much of my childhood. And so I'm familiar with, you know, being alone or with one other person or two other people on a river. But it is really special, I think, to get out there and be able to paddle alone. And while I could take a solo canoe, a kayak just makes it so much easier for me to manipulate in small places. I have a 12-foot kayak. It's a Kestrel. It's made by Current Designs, and it allows me to get back into places. See, paddlers can get into places that people with motors on their boats cannot, and it's quiet, and so you
can
see
sneak
things.
Up on wildlife,
oh,
right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's amazing how many times I've come around a bend in the river, and I see so much because first of all you're paddling, and second of all you're alone, and that makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Jim, give us an idea of what you were taking in as you paddled through.
Yeah, well, it was. There are all kinds of things. It depends very much on the river, and you're trying to have both the close view and the wide angle view as well. So I will paddle with my binoculars around my neck. I'll have a little digital recorder on my arm. I have the GPS in front of me, and I have my camera in my lap. So and it allows me to take GPS coordinates of various things along the way, from either dangerous things to, there's a big log jam here. We ought to see what can be done about that, to, ooh, here's an eagle's nest, and we'll get GPS coordinates on that. Or here's a juvenile eagle. I don't find the nest, but this is a young of the year, and so we know it was produced around here someplace close by, so we ought to be looking for a nest in the area. Taking photos of great blue herons and owls, to taking a look at what the vegetation is like along the river. And it really does vary from river to river, not only in the width of what's called the riparian zone, the area that is immediately along the river or stream, but what's out beyond that as well. And, of course, in Iowa, being an agricultural state, an awful lot of what is out beyond that riparian zone are row crops and or cattle or sheep or, you know, other livestock in that area. But taking that in, because you have to look at it from a paddler's view. What is it that paddlers are going to see as they go along this river? For example, if you paddle the Little Sioux River up in northwest Iowa, that's a prairie river, and that's really, really neat because you have there are a lot of prairie preserves along that river, and so you're paddling through this these blooming wildflowers. It's just amazing. Other places, many other rivers in the state, because rivers have the most dependable water supply. There are trees and woodlands are primarily along our rivers, of course. Mm-hmm. And so you would see rivers that, as John mentioned earlier, don't mind, or you see trees that that don't mind having their feet wet, their roots in the water, down below the water table, things mm-hmm. like silver maple and cottonwoods and willows, where in some areas you just have to raise that land just a little bit, maybe a few feet, and all of a sudden there are oaks and there are maples and other the hard maples and basswoods and those sorts of things. So it's really it's fascinating to watch it. Also, doing it through the summer, I've been able to watch the bloom change mm-hmm. as we go through the summer as I paddle different rivers. You know, elderberry, for example, is a fairly common shrub in Iowa. And it blooms in July for berries that are pickable right about now. And the birds are starting to harvest those along the way. So,
all right. Well, it's Wildlife Day today on Talk of Iowa. With me, our guests, wildlife biologist Jim Pease and John Wink from the Iowa DNR. And Jim has spent the last few months paddling Iowa's rivers, and today he shares his experience with us. And you can join our conversation as well. Do you live by or frequent Iowa's rivers or enjoy nature watches from a kayak? Share what you've seen with us at 866-780-9100. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Charity Nebbe. It's Wildlife Day today, and with me is Jim Pease, wildlife biologist from Iowa State, and John Wink, Water Trails Coordinator for the Iowa DNR. And they're here with me to talk about a comprehensive project to map out the biology of Iowa's rivers and riverbanks. And so far, Jim has paddled the Lower Des Moines River, the Middle Cedar, the Lower Iowa, Upper Iowa, and the Maquoketa, the West Fork of Des Moines, the West Nishnabotna, and part of the Little Sioux. And Jim, you still have to finish up another couple hundred miles of the Little Sioux and Big Sioux.
Right.
How
yeah.
are your arms feeling?
Oh, if I
I'm tired just talking
arm
about
wrestle?
It.
Is that yeah, I've been challenging lots of people arm wrestling now. No, it's really been a delight. It's been a challenge this summer because we've had, as our listeners will know, there in different parts of the state, in different parts of the summer, we've had very high water levels, and so I've had to kind of hopscotch around to different parts of the state. I take a look at the USGS stream gauges on the web, and find which one of the rivers that I'm working on is paddleable at a given time. Now, of course, now we're into August, and so some are actually the Little Sioux may end up waiting until spring because it's so low right now. I'm glad I got the upper end of it done already mm-hmm. in Dickinson County, but I don't think the rest of it is paddleable right now. But and that's true of some other rivers. The Upper Iowa, when I paddled, it was perfect. I happened to choose just the right week or so that I was up there, some of our rivers, of course, are controlled by the amount of water that's let out of the dams. So the Lower Des Moines, for example, was a challenge. Had to find it when there wasn't a lot of rain up on the watershed, so that Lake Red Rock Dam was not letting out too much water. And, in fact, I was going to do a paddle down there with with families, local families that were coming to learn about the river, and we had to change the date on that because it was just there was too much water too fast, mm-hmm. and you don't want to take a lot of beginning paddlers out on that kind of water. So,
sure.
So we've had to do that a little later. But it's been, you know, the wildlife you see very much depends, I think, on how you approach the river. Clearly, you'd see more early in the morning or in the evening because so much wildlife tends to try to avoid human interaction. So they choose those what are called crepuscular times, the dawn and dusk sorts of times to be active. And but I don't always get out there early. And it has been amazing to me how much wildlife I see in the middle of the day, things I didn't expect to see. And that includes things like lots and lots and lots of owls. There were rivers that I was averaging at least one owl every 2 miles. it was just amazing. We have of course three major main species of owls. There are other species as well, but three. That's the great horn, the barred, and the screech owl, and I've talked about all those on other programs on the air and previously. But the most diurnal, the most day-dwelling of those three would be the barred. And they're also, it turns out, to be the most aquatic. So we would expect to see them, you know, kind of along the river. But I am seeing an enormous number of great horned owls. And I've always called the great horned owl the tiger of the woods, you know, and think of them as being very, very terrestrial. I think they may be much more aquatic than we've ever given them credit for. I watched one be about a week and a half ago now as it came up right in the middle of the day, came off the shoreline with a snake in its talon in the middle of the day. So I think the reason they're so successful is that they're predators that are pretty adaptable, and they're able to maybe hunt more in the daytime than we have thought in the past. It's quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And they're not so mammal-oriented maybe mm-hmm. as we thought. They're predators are opportunistic, and so they're taking advantage of where the critters are and the time of day where they are.
Mm-hmm. We have this email from Nick in Chicago. He says, what's been the biggest surprise so far for you, Jim? Would you say it's seeing those owls during the daytime?
Well, there have been a number of surprises. I think the owls, the numbers of the owls and seeing them in the daytime and seeing them not necessarily in trees, but actually right on the banks.
Just on the ground.
Right mm-hmm. on the ground. It's been very surprising to me. And secondly, the number of softshell turtles I've seen. Softshells are, I grew up with softshell turtles in all of those rivers in southeastern Iowa. But it was seeing so many of them, and on some rivers they're more prevalent than on others. One of the rivers that I called the surprising river to me was the West Nishnabotna in southwest Iowa, mm-hmm. because it's a channelized river, and I didn't really expect to see a lot of wildlife, and yet I really saw a lot, and I would come around a small bend there, and there would be not one or two, but a dozen or more softshell turtles go piling off the mud bar, the sandbar there into the water, and they'd stick those long necks up and their little nostrils that serve almost like a snorkel above the water mm-hmm. surface, and I could quickly identify which ones they were. So it was really, that's been really surprising. The other thing that has been surprising to me in sort of a negative way is the number of how much education we have left to do with folks who are using our rivers, and that has really been that's been both it's sort of been the reason I'm doing this for me. I don't want just more river users. I want more intelligent river users, mm-hmm. people who understand more about the resource that we have, this incredible resource that we have in our rivers and streams, and people who come to appreciate how amazing it is. I don't expect everybody to go into it with the same degree of awe and love and kinship that I have necessarily, but I want them to have the opportunity to know what else is out there on the river, the critters and the plants and the wildlife. That's two words that we share this planet with, and rivers are one of the best places to see it. And so when I see people using the river in a way that is degrading that river, that bothers me. That bothers me.
What specifically did you see that bothered you?
Well, for example, picking up lots and lots of beer cans along the way, and it's basically it's two brands, and they're very cheap brands. So, so it's amazing to me I don't understand how people can carry something in full, but they can't carry it out empty. It's carelessness, and so I don't think it's necessarily forgetfulness. I think it's mainly carelessness. John?
And Emily, I might add here, one of the reasons that we're going through this planning process is to find out what those issues are on these different rivers. And river management is part of that. How do you solve that problem when maybe a stretch of river is being overused?
Right.
And that's that's part of our mission, really, is the DNR's mission is leading Iowans and caring for their natural resources, and in order to do this, I mean, this is why we have Jim out there going around looking or paddling all these rivers and finding out what is so cool and what is so exciting and unique about each one of those, so that people can learn to value them more. And maybe not participate in some of those activities that do degrade. It's kind of silly to think that we can just eliminate that problem. But how can we work locally to solve those issues? And so part of the planning process is each one of our coordinators that are working in these areas is to listen to the landowners. Because the landowners who live adjacent to rivers are experiencing this more than anybody.
Sure.
And so we listen to them. We listen to the law enforcement, emergency management folks. We listen to the land managers, the ones who have to maintain and manage the accesses. And we're hearing, in some of these areas, like Jim mentioned, that there's overuse and misuse of the rivers, and we want to try with our Water Trails program to help solve some of those problems.
But I think we could start a campaign. I've thought about different themes for this campaign. It says, I think it is, "Your mother doesn't live here. Pick up after yourself."
Right,
so,
right.
So right. I don't know. There's a lot of education, and John's right. I've seen misbehavior by some folks using the rivers that is I understand how landowners can find that very disturbing. But that hasn't been the primary thing I've seen along the rivers. But there certainly are some issues that we still have to solve. Let me tell you something else that I've seen, and that of course is a lot of wildlife. And one of the things I'm writing, in addition to the 15 to 20 page reports on each of these rivers, I'm calling them interpretive vignettes, and I'm encouraging John and the river, the local coordinators, they can use these if they want, any way they want, and pop them into brochures or interpretive signage, that sort of thing, to help Iowans understand more what it is they're seeing. So these are small topics, often single species, but here's one called Engineering a Nest, and if I can just read this on the air, I think we have time in this section.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
So it's called Engineering a Nest. Paddlers on most any Iowa river can hear the clear whistle notes of an oriole's song, be they Baltimore or Orchard. Orioles sing happiness to paddlers, but their engineering feats will amaze you even more. Using just their beak and their feet, they pull strips of bark from grapevines, plant fibers from the stems of old goldenrods and milkweeds, and dried blades of grasses and sedges. Then they weave them into a 5 to 7 inch deep cup, including weaving the rim of the cup around the Y branches of a tree, often 20 or 30 feet above the water. The hangingness must withstand the summer windstorms, rain, and even hail. After lining it with fine grasses and any hair they can find, they lay 4 or 5 eggs in there and incubate them for a couple of weeks by sitting on them. Again, they accomplish all this weaving just using their beak and feet. Sound easy? You try it. using just your mouth and feet, no hands with opposable thumbs, please, gather plant fibers, weave them into a hanging net that will withstand Iowa's summer winds and rains. Oh, and hang it over the river 20 to 30 feet high and put your kids in there. Would you trust your engineering skills? Orioles do. Admire their handiwork and their engineering as you float beneath their nest. So that's one I've written, and there are lots of naturalists in the state who do that sort of thing live with people. But this gives them an opportunity; they can put it into signage or brochures, or you know, alter it in some way to make it very appropriate.
It really makes you appreciate, like you said, the engineering skills of a bird.
Yeah.
You'd never think, you know, that much work goes into it.
Oh, yeah. And another great engineer, of course, along the river are beavers. And you say, beaver? I thought beavers built in lakes and dammed up little streams. Well, they're along Iowa rivers as well. And their houses are not the sort of traditional, you know, dome-shaped houses that you see in the movies on northern lakes, and you can see those in northern lakes. But along Iowa rivers, these are usually bank-dwelling beavers. Their entrances are below normal water levels and are sometimes exposed when the rivers go even lower. And they simply pile branches up against the bank. And sometimes they're very subtle and hard to see. And so I've been taking lots of photos of various beaver constructions along the way. And
we actually have that photo on our website of a beaver house resting on Exchange Park. And we have a lot of other of your photos, Jim, posted on our website, iowapublicradio.org, also on our Facebook page. And these photos are just gorgeous. It really does make you appreciate, you know, seeing these things. And was it kind of common to, I mean, these photos are great. And did you find a lot of these? How many photos did you take?
Oh, I usually take, John, what is it? I give John between 150 and 200 per river, maybe
a lot.
More.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of wildlife out there to see.
There really is. There really is. There are lots and lots of great blue herons. Yeah. Great blue herons, of course, are they nest in groups, and so they have what are called heronries or rookeries, and those are often in one of the woodlands on the side of the river, but they are not always right in the woodland shore. They can nest, you know, a mile or so in an upland a woodland away from the river. Often within sight, but not necessarily. And so it's hard sometimes to know where their rookeries are just because you're seeing lots of herons. And this time of year, of course, there are both adult herons and lots of young ones that are out there as well. So lots and lots of great blue herons. And even the little green heron. I think there's a photo that I sent you on your website of a little green heron. And they're less common, but they're really cool to watch them along a river.
Mm-hmm. And we're coming up on a break here in just a minute, but we have a quick question maybe we can get to from Craig in Cedar Rapids. He says, how would you keep the waterways open to the public if beavers were reintroduced in a big way?
Well, beavers have reintroduced themselves. Beavers were quite common on Iowa rivers back in the 1800s and then got wiped out due to lack of any laws to protect them or any. So people took, like deer and everything else, they took as much as they wanted, whenever they wanted, and as many as they wanted. And, of course, they disappeared from the Iowa landscape. But they've come back on their own, and they're managed by some trappers and certainly on some small streams. Occasionally when they cause flooding problems, people do go in and remove or destroy that dam area. But it's probably a much too short a time to answer that completely, but they are certainly managed in Iowa as one of the trap species, as a fur bearer.
All right. Well, it's Wildlife Day on Talk of Iowa. We'll be back in just a minute. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for host Charity Nebbe. And it's Wildlife Day today. With me here is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, who has spent the last few months paddling Iowa's rivers, gathering data, information, photos, all sorts of things from all types of wildlife. And also joining us is John Wink, the Water Trails Coordinator for the Iowa DNR. And I'd like to get to the phones really quick. Here's a question from, Bill in Davenport. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My question is, having canoed in Iowa and Illinois rivers for years, I have occasionally seen signs of river otters on the Maquoketa River near Monticello. I thought I saw a slide a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything like river otter activity?
That's a great question, Bill. And I thought I would see a lot more than I have, because the reintroduction of otters to Iowa has been very, very successful. And it's one of the many species that the DNR and hunting and trapping groups have been very successful at reintroducing them. So I thought I would see maybe even otters themselves, particularly paddling alone. But again, those are a species that is reasonably shy around people. So if I was out there real early in the morning or really late in the evening, I'd be much more likely to actually see the river otters. However, I have seen a number of places where the slides are. And, of course, the slides can be used by more than just otters. They can be used by beaver, other mammal species like raccoons that would come down to the water, certainly deer. But you would usually – with deer, you usually see the tracks in the mud. But both beaver and otter will use very very similar slides, and it's hard to tell them apart unless you can see their tracks in the mud along the shoreline. And with otter, that's certainly a possibility. You may be able to determine the difference. But, they're certainly out there. There's no question at all. And what river did you see this on? On the Maquoketa?
It was on the Maquoketa just a little bit after we left the McDonough canoe rental area.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
sure.
A quarter of a mile.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great area. So you bet. Yeah, that's certainly a river that no pun intended, of course.
Can I ask one quick question about smallmouth fishing in the rivers?
Sure.
After the dam at Delhi broke and the water was pretty much flushed down the Maquoketa,
mm-hmm.
Has the river fishing stabilized in that area?
I'm not sure what you mean by stabilize, but certainly smallmouth have worked their way back upriver very well. This happens in a lot of Iowa rivers. Last year, for example, when we had a couple of months, July and August, where we didn't have much rain at all, I know in my local river here, the Skunk, there were just pools left. There really wasn't a lot of flow between those pools. And I'm amazed at how quickly smallmouth reoccupied the upper reaches of the river. So, they're back in the Maquoketa. I talked to a number of fishermen along the way, and certainly smallmouth were being caught.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Bill. We have another otter question from Doug in Donaldson. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Hi. You're on there.
Hey. Okay, thanks. I paddle quite a bit, and I, you know, sandy bottom rivers, I see quite a few clams, and that just looks like easy picking for otters, and I wonder what effect the otters are going to have as there are more and more of them on the clam population.
Well, that's a very good question, and certainly mussels in Iowa rivers have lived with otters for millennia, and before Euro Americans got here and sort of took otters out of the picture, and only in recent years have otters been in sufficient numbers to have any impact. I suspect that certainly while they are a predator on various mussel species, mussels are pretty adept because there are lots of other predators that have taken them on, continued to eat them, particularly raccoons. And raccoons have become very, very numerous along our rivers, and they are very efficient and effective at clamming, as it were. I've seen raccoons in our rivers in the middle of the day on some of the more isolated stretches out in the river in the rocks crawling. In fact, I sent John some photos of them absolutely the middle of the day out there working their way across this rock dam, pulling mussels out of the bottom. So they're not the only predator, and I've actually seen crows as well capturing in shallow backwaters, grabbing clams out, and I watched a crow actually peck through the shell and then eat the mussel out of the middle. So there are lots of predators on mussels, and as long as mussels have clean water and appropriate levels of nutrients so that they have the right habitat for them, the mussels will continue to be there.
And if you have questions, if you've seen things along Iowa River banks, you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100 or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I encourage you, if you're listening to this conversation, like some visuals to go along with it, you can see a lot of pictures from Jim's journey on our Facebook page, also at iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, I'd love to have you read another one of your interpretive vignettes before the end of the hour. And I would like to pick this one because you sent me some ahead of time. And this one, I don't really know what it's about, but it's called Bird Diapers.
Bird Diapers, yes.
What is that?
Okay. Paddling brings one amazing insight into the natural world if we pay attention. Even blackbirds give us things to think about. You may have already experienced being pooped on by birds flying over, but you may not have thought about why. They're not just targeting you. As red-winged blackbirds or grackles fly over the river, don't just ignore them because they're so common. Rather, watch them carefully. Often they're carrying a white bag about the size of your thumbnail in their beaks. As they fly over the water, they drop it and fly back to their nests. Red-winged blackbirds are solitary nesters, building a hanging nest in low shrubs or in cattails over the water. Safety in isolation is their motto. Grackles are semi-colonial, building nests in dense trees, often evergreens like red cedars, with 6 to 12 other like-minded grackles in the vicinity. Safety in numbers is their motto. Both of these strategies work. Yet both still worry about predators. Mammalian predators in particular are adept at using their sense of smell to track down the nests of baby birds and other prey. Baby birds grow fast and as a result have a lot of waste. You'd think they would just drop it off the side of the nest. Ah, yes, but the wily mammal predator would then find it easy to find and eat the baby birds. So grackles and red-winged blackbirds, babies, dispose of their waste in fecal sacks, a sort of bird poop in a bag, if you will. Think of them as bird diapers. The parent then simply grabs a corner of the fecal membrane, carries it well away from the nest, and drops it, often over water. Why water? Because it is unsmellable and therefore untrackable by mammal predator noses, of course. So the next time you get pooped on while paddling down an Iowa river, don't be upset. Just think of all the baby blackbirds you're helping.
Silver lining.
That's right. There's always a silver lining. You bet.
Well, Jim, were there any species that you wish you saw more of on this trip, or maybe even less of? Did you see any invasive species or...
Yeah, there are certainly, as in all Iowa woodlands across the state, whether they're along rivers or not, we have invasive species of plants in particular. And that includes things like bush honeysuckle and common buckthorn and even garlic mustard. I would see in certain areas along certain rivers, I would see a lot of that. Also, you can tell a lot about the land management from if you learn how to read the landscape from the species you see. For example, honey locust is a tree that has very long thorns and is not eaten by cattle, for example. So where you have pasture along a river, I mean, I can tell from a distance when I'm coming into a pasture because I'll often see, particularly if it's overgrazed, I'll often see a predominance of the whole lowland being honey locust. Gleditsia is the genus. So I say, oh, more Gleditsia. And it may be solid honey locust. That tells me that particular land manager has not done a good job of watching, of reading his own landscape or her own landscape and seeing what's happening to it. And it's pretty easy to see that from the river. So when you have this, because they eat other things, but then the honey locust grows up and becomes the dominant species. So it's the kind of thing landowners really can make a difference in how they manage the land. And you see this as you drive down our roads in a town or city or out in the country. Different people manage their own landscape in different ways, and some seem to be very effective at it, and others are much more haphazard. Mm-hmm. Lots of times, there are places I paddled where there's an electric fence across the river, and you don't know that it's unless you know what you're looking for and know to look for it. It's right about neck level. So it can be a real problem. No. But then there are landowners that actually provide not only warning signs for that with banners hanging down, not banners, but ribbon hanging from them. But I've encountered a couple that actually provide foam handles on them. So they know the paddlers are going to be there, and so that you simply grab the foam handle and lift the fence over your head. And it's, wow. This is a landowner who really cares, you know, yeah. And really mm-hmm. is respectful of other people using the river besides him or herself. So it's nice to encounter those landowners who be it city or country, really think about that the management of that land.
And Wyatt is calling in from Dubuque. And Wyatt, is this something you're concerned about? I believe your question is about people plowing or bulldozing along the riverbanks.
Yeah, I live in Dubuque County, and I frequent the Little Maquoketa, Catfish Creek, and Bloody Run Creek, all within at least 15 minutes of my house. And I'm seeing just an incredible amount of bulldozing along the riverside, literally plowing and planting right into the riverbank. I've seen spots where it looks like either the chisel or the tine was like hanging off of the riverbank.
And when you say planting, also, do you mean agriculture?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Planting corn or soybeans right into the riverbank. And also bulldozing down the riverbank in order to drive tractors back and forth, drive tractors or equipment back and forth through, and you can see the big gullies and runouts. And if you or anyone else encounters these things and would like to document, you can post them on soilpatrol.org with your smartphone. But I've just I'm concerned about what I'm seeing in Dubuque County and wondering how much of that's going on in the rest of the state.
Well, yeah, thanks for your call, Wyatt.
It really varies a lot, I found, from not just county to county, but from river to river, because I think like many things, there's sort of a culture in an area where people are expected to either leave a buffer along the rivers, and they just do it automatically, and other areas in the state where that's not the culture, and they plant right up to the edge. And, of course, with very, very high commodity prices the last few years, we have seen not only fence rows disappear, and I've talked about that on the program, and small woodlots and old farmsteads that were once abandoned now are turned into row crop. And that, from a wildlife standpoint, boy, all those little things add up. And we're certainly seeing that along rivers as well, but not every river. There are rivers I've been along, and there are wide buffers. Boy, they do a good job of that. And they're all fenced. There are other rivers where they are, as Wyatt mentioned, planted right up to the edge, and they're losing crop into the river every year. It doesn't make any sense to me, but we have to change that culture somehow. And be it voluntary or by regulation, somehow we need to find a way. And, of course, everybody would prefer that it be voluntary, that the culture changes so that we use our rivers, not only people that are paddling, but people who are along the rivers. We use them intelligently and with great care because they are a resource that we have in Iowa that is absolutely amazing, and we've begun not taking them for granted. John, would you agree?
Yes, I would definitely agree, and I think there are a lot of Iowans out there who have yet to experience Iowa's rivers, and I think as you said, Emily, earlier or on one of your the ads that, you know, I feel personally like I'm seeing Iowa for the first time because my first experience was getting out on the river for a friend had hounded me for about 7 months to get me to paddle out on the river and on the Des Moines River within the metro area. And I didn't think you could actually paddle Iowa's rivers. I really didn't. And so this was my first experience paddling, and it was in October of 2004. About 6 o'clock in the morning, he had to go to work at 7, so it was a short paddle. But we got in just below the Euclid Avenue Bridge. We paddled upstream past the Euclid Avenue Bridge. Of course, cars were flying back and forth on their way to work, you know. And we looked up, and in this tall cottonwood tree was a bald eagle. And I felt like I was on the edge of two worlds, you know, the world that I was familiar with, the cars flying back and forth to and fro, but then this eagle sitting up in this tall cottonwood tree. And that was my first experience, and I've been hooked ever since. So I hope more Iowans can experience that same experience, and I guess that's why I'm where I'm at today.
Oh, well, thank you both so much for joining us. What a great wildlife day. Jim Pease, wildlife biologist at Iowa State University, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And John Wink of the Iowa DNR, he's the Water Trails Coordinator. Thank you, John.
Yep, thank you. I really appreciate being on the show.
And again, you can see some of the photos from Jim's trip. They're on iowapublicradio.org, also on our Facebook page. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury. Thank you for joining us.